So tonight I'm starting the first of a series of four talks on the four Brahma Viharas. And tonight, though, I want to talk a little bit about them in the broad sense. I'm going to spend most of my time talking about metta. So there are four Brahma Viharas, right? Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And when I was taught this, I was taught to think of them as four faces of a jewel. There are, like a, it's a tetrahedron. I'm an old math guy, right? So a tetrahedron is a four-sided object, and each of the four faces depend on the other three for stability, so they all interact with each other continually, which is a good way to think about the Brahma Viharas. We think of them as four separate things, but as I go through this series of talks, you'll see that they're very strongly related to each other. So people have asked me many times over the last many years, as I've taught these things, the Brahma Viharas, what does that mean? What's a Brahma Vihara, right? where does that come from? And I've always sort of, to be honest with you, sort of blown off those questions and said, well, they usually are called the divine abodes, where we live in our hearts, right? But I was talking about this with my wife, who's a Sanskrit scholar and a linguist, and of course she had to go look this up and see what's going on, because she, first of all, the Brahma Viharas also occur in the Rajayoga Sutras of Patanjali, the famous yogic text, and which she just finished teaching. So she was had come across this in a couple of other occasions. So Brahma, the word Brahma is one of the Hindu gods, and Brahma is typically depicted as having four faces. So he's got one head, but four faces that face in the four directions. And I went, oh, that's interesting. Because in the sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, there's this whole thing where the Buddha is talking about how one expresses when one is deeply imbued with the teachings, how the expression of the Brahma Viharas comes out. And it says, he abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. Oh. So it's one quarter of the mind imbued. And then, so wait, a head with four faces has one mind in the middle and four quarters that face in different directions. In fact, it's taught in some places, apparently, I was told, that Brahma sort of exudes the Brahma Viharas. Each of those four faces have the energy of one of these four teachings, one of these four wholesome mental formations, wholesome heart-mind states, however you want to think of it. And so this, I think this is really interesting, because we think of the Buddha as a Buddhist, but actually the Buddha was a Hindu. For the first 29 years of his life, he grew up in a very traditional Brahmanic cultural household. Where they were of a certain caste, I'm sure he was very, very knowledgeable about the teachings, about the various gods and goddesses within that tradition. And so, for him to call this the Brahma Viharas was perfectly normal. The word vihara, by the way, means to dwell. So just like we in the Pali Canon, we talk about abiding in some place. Vihara is like to dwell, to abide. So it's the same thing. It's this come that the original language source comes from way before the Buddha. Just you see this. Yeah, and just one other little aspect of this. I was thinking about this because, you know, I was, before I came to these teachings, I was involved in very deeply taught in a Hindu tradition with all the gods and goddesses and all this sort of thing. And the three primary gods are Brahma, the creator. So Brahma is the creator of the universe, right? This is the creative energy, how things arise. Then there's Vishnu, who's the preserver, and Shiva, who's the destroyer. Oh, things arise, they're preserved, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. Oh, what a surprise. here's the Buddhist teachings again, only, you know, within the Hindu tradition, this is like something you just believe. And the Buddha said, no, I can't believe anything. I have to actually experience it. And he even actually experienced this and took it out of the context of Hinduism. But it's the same idea, that everything is either arising, is there for a while, and then it's gone. So there's this history that goes back into the tradition. Anyhow, let's move on to metta. So metta, the first of these, and usually you see this metta, the word metta translated as loving kindness. And this is to separate it from love in the, you know, Western sense of that, what that word means, because love can mean, you know, I love watching baseball, you know, or I love you, baby, or whatever. This is loving kindness, which is more focused on the kindness part from a loving heart, right? So it's a different aspect. Another translation you'll see sometimes for metta is goodwill. Having an attitude of goodwill towards all beings, as opposed to an attitude of ill will or wishing individuals or groups of individuals to suffer, which is what ill will is. And so basically the idea behind metta is that we're trying to have our heart, mind, full of thoughts of loving kindness towards all beings at all times. Which, when you think about it, is like, yeah, sure. Right? It seems like a tall order. But that's where this practice is directed. It's actually directed at exactly that. You know, in the Metta Sutta, there's three or four times in the one sutta, which is about 40 lines, where the Buddha emphasizes everyone, that you can't leave anyone out. Yeah, and that's where it gets interesting, shall we say. So on the face of it, it seems like, oh yeah, I'm a good person. I'm a really nice. I tend to be very sort of kind and sweet, and I'm a nice guy, and of course I can have thoughts of loving kindness for all beings all the time. But the truth is, my mind isn't like that. And for most of us, I don't want to speak for any of you individually, but I'm sure all of you know that there are times your mind is somewhat less than full of loving kindness. It's like growling about something, or something that happened at work, and there's this guy at work that makes you crazy, or you know, this, your crazy uncle who just upsets the family Thanksgiving dinner every year. And we all have people like this. We all have times when we're not full of loving kindness. In fact, our mind is quite otherwise. So what the Buddha does, what the Buddha did, is he said, first of all, yes, that's true. My mind isn't always full of loving kindness. So I have to do something. I have to cultivate loving kindness. We can't just sort of assume that that's how we are all the time. We can't have this sort of, you know, rose-colored glasses view of our own nature. We have to, at the very beginning, accept the fact that we're not yet. We want to head in that direction. We're going there, but we're not there yet. We have to take that in and be okay with it. So basically, we have to cultivate. And this is the word that the Buddha used. Remember, the Buddha was speaking in a very agrarian society. Like 95% of the people just grew food. You know, they lived off the land, quite literally. You know. And so the idea of cultivating would be something that people would understand. I actually looked up cultivate in the dictionary, and there's actually three definitions, and all three of them I like. One was just to encourage. So we want to encourage our mind to be more likely to be full of loving kindness, right? To foster the growth of. I mean, we want to cultivate something is just to make things grow. We want our heart, the love and kindness in our heart, to grow over time. And then there's to prepare and use for the raising of crops. In other words, get things, you know, make sure the gland is fertile. Make sure our mind is open to this. Our heart mind is willing to take this in. And the last of these is a great sort of metaphor that we can use in the context of a right effort and the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. You know, if we're going to put in effort to actually start to shift our habits of heart mind more and more towards having love and kindness, then we have to use our effort wisely, right? And that's what right effort, the sixth step in the Eightfold Path, is all about. You know, so to prepare things, to grow things on the ground, you know, the first thing you have to do is you take out all the big stones and pull out all the weeds. You know, and then this is sort of like, you know, the first step of right effort. You know, right effort where it says, you know, to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising, and to get rid of unwholesome mind states that have arisen. So if you go out, you know, if you're planting a garden, this is gardening season, so I'm very sort of aware of this. If you're planting a garden, you got to do a lot before you put any seeds in the ground or any plants. You have to, you know, cultivate the land. You have to take out the stones and pull out the weeds and put in some fertilizer and you know, make sure the soil is nice and loose and, you know, turn it over and all these sort of things we have to do to get ready. Well, that's what we have to do with our mind. We actually have to look at the mind and go, oh, look at that big stone over there where when I started thinking about the orange-haired guy or whatever, you know. It's like there's this big block, and I have to dig that big rock out and move it aside if I'm going to cultivate correctly, wholesomely. And we, once again, we like to think that we're normally kind to others. But actually, it's not always true. You know, and part of this is purely biological. At the level of sort of our brainstem, our instinctual reaction to the world, we're always sort of basically looking out for trouble. We're always concerned that something's going to happen at some sort of basic instinctual level, because, you know, 10,000 years ago when we, you know, lived in our little, you know, bison skin tent out in the plains someplace, we were always worried about, you know, someone coming and attacking us, or animals coming, or something's going to get in the way and steal my food, steal my wife, steal my children. It was like, we have to be on the lookout all the time, because otherwise we were going to get squashed by one of the things out there that wanted to squash us and wanted our stuff. And So there's this sort of instinctual level where we're always sort of thinking there's something wrong, something we got to watch for, got to worry, got to be nervous. And then our culture, certainly our current culture, I don't know, I don't know about you, but I actually, read the New York Times every day. And I don't read the whole thing, but I read chunks of it. And if you look at at anything, any sort of news source like that now, like 90% of it is not cheerful stuff. It's not like, oh, isn't this all sweet and full of loving kindness? It's like, look what this guy did and this person did and these people did and that and how this person reacted. It's all the opposite. And that's part of the culture that we're embedded in. And so that makes us not have thoughts of loving kindness if we're not careful. And so we have to sort of look at all these ingrained cultural, instinctual mind habits and see them for what they are and go, oh, but I don't need to react that way. I don't have to be that way. I can choose, I can consciously cultivate a wholesome mind state of loving kindness, which is the second part of right effort, which is, create the conditions where wholesome mind states can arise and preserve these mind states once they have arisen. It's a very traditional statement on right effort. So, if we're going to plant the seeds of loving kindness, then we have to actually, turn the soil, plant the seeds, add the fertilizer, water the plants, make sure no more weeds arise, and then harvest. Finally, we get to harvest and enjoy, right? That's the way we grow food. But it's, once again, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. I've been working a lot in my garden lately, and I'm amazed how much work it is. But I like doing it so much. It's sort of like my recreation time. I go and dig in the dirt for an hour or something. But it's not. It takes effort. So does metta. And so the practice of metta. The practice of metta. Has this sort of form. And first of all, I want to say that the form I'm about to talk about is just one of many forms. And you can go and talk to different Buddhists and different Buddhist traditions. And even within the Theravada tradition, there's lots of different ways that people teach and practice, teach how to practice metta. But what I learned and what I teach and what I practice is a 2,000, essentially 2,000-year-old system. It comes from something called the Abhidhamma, which was a commentary and sort of compendium of Buddhist teaching around the birth of Christ, so to about 2,000 years ago. And in it is this very precise description of how to practice the metta as a meditative form. And it's very much just trying to cultivate loving kindness. Actually, it's setting the creating the causes and conditions. That's a good way. Creating the causes and conditions such that the wholesome mind state of metta might arise. Just like in mindfulness, practicing the form, creating causes and conditions, so that mindfulness, which is another wholesome mind state, might arise. Same thing. And so, in the Abhidhamma, basically it said, place some person or some group of people, something in your heart mind, and then just repeat these phrases. And in a sense, feel as if you're offering these phrases to this person or these people. You know, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. These are the traditional four statements. And when you think about it, if you were always felt safe, happy, healthy, and live with ease means not have to worry about, you know, getting your next meal and not having to worry about having a roof over your head, having ideal sort of basic living conditions, life would be pretty good. If that was all, that was your normal everyday conditions, you know. So in some sense, the idea behind metta is to wish that other people, all other people over time within the practice form, have these ideal conditions for life. Because if they have ideal conditions for life, then they'll have time to practice. Then they'll have time to actually, you know, tune into the Buddha's teachings and practice. That's what we're wishing. We're wishing that they have a perfect practice space, essentially. I mean, it's not like we want them just to be sort of happy and carefree, which is nice, but we want to actually create the causes and conditions in their life that they'll be able to practice without distraction. You know, if you're safe, happy, healthy, and living at ease, there's not much in the way of distractions in your life. And so basically, we, you know, the idea is that you would just repeat these phrases. These phrases become your meditation object. You know, you reflect on the meaning of the phrases, so that which makes it more powerful and more likely that your mind will wander. But just like any other meditative form, you know, you're repeating the phrases, and then your mind wanders off someplace, who knows where or why, and then you sort of realize that's what's happened, and then you just start repeating the phrases again. And the interesting thing, here's the next interesting thing, and this is very clearly stated both in the Abhidhamma teachings and in all the teachings I've ever received from any teacher I've ever studied with when it comes to metta. And that's that you have to start by practicing for yourself. You have to be able to have thoughts of loving kindness towards yourself. You know, so instead the phrases become, may I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. And it seems, you know, at one level we go, ooh, it's sort of like selfish. Right? Why should I be? I'm supposed to take care of everyone else, right? It's a cultural idea that we're supposed to be taking care of other people all the time. You know, taking care of our loved one, taking care of those people close to me, taking care of the world in the broadest sense, perhaps even. But if we don't have thoughts of loving kindness towards ourselves, pretty hard to have thoughts of loving kindness towards other people. You know, the idea behind the practice, the actual form, is that if we're just repeating these phrases over and over and over again and staying with it, then we're literally filling our mind with thoughts of loving kindness, which is trying to, which means we're trying to create the causes and conditions by repeating the phrases such that the wholesome mental formation of metta might actually arise. Because our minds can only have one thing at a time in them. So if I'm filling the mind with thoughts of loving kindness, then there's no room for unwholesomeness. There's no room for the other stuff. It just doesn't fit. So I'm busy filling and keeping the mind full of wholesome thoughts. And this seems like, well, yeah, this is okay. I see I could do that for, people close to me and people I like and, maybe my favorite hockey team or whatever, some those things that we, where we have a natural tendency to want to have thoughts of love and kindness towards people. But then we come across all those people. There's first of all, there's like people that we just blow off every day. The thousands of people we interact with in our life who are out there on the very much on the periphery. People who store clerks, and I just got my hair cut, and so I went to a barber, and the barber cut my hair, and I paid my money and left. Had a little slight conversation, but it's very, there's lots of transactional relationships that we have where we thought having thoughts of loving kindness towards these people is like, huh? It's not something we would normally naturally do unless we're consciously trying to cultivate thoughts of loving kindness towards everyone. And then there's people we have difficulty with. In the Abhidhamma, this category of people is called the enemy. In the world of Western teaching of metta, that's been softened to be difficult to people. We don't like to think we have enemies, but we all know we have difficult people. And to have thoughts of loving kindness towards them can actually sometimes be quite effortful. It's like something you have to really work at. So we have to start with ourselves, because if we can't have loving kindness towards ourselves, then things get in the way, literally. I want to read a couple of things here. This is Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And she has very sort of sweet language around everything here, but I like the way she writes. The practice of metta, uncovering the force of love that can uproot fear, anger, and guilt, begins with befriending ourselves. The foundation of metta practice is to know how to be our own friend. According to the Buddha, you can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself, and that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the universe, deserves your love and affection. This is actually from the Samyutta Nikaya, in 3.8 in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's actually something, it's a dialogue with a king and a queen in the Buddha. And the king and the queen say, no, I have to have, my partner should be the person who deserves my thoughts of loving kindness more than I do. And the Buddha said, made them wake up to the fact that they had to take care of themselves first. They had to sort of have thoughts of loving kindness for themselves, then that energy would naturally flow into their relationship with their partner. So, anyhow. How few of us embrace ourselves in this way? With metta practice, we uncover the possibility of truly respecting ourselves. We discover, as Walt Whitman put it, I am larger and better than I thought. I do not think I held so much goodness. Directly seeing the natural radiance of our minds reteaches us our own loveliness. I love this line from Sharon. Directly seeing the natural radiance of our minds reteaches us our own loveliness. To allude to a phrase in the Zen tradition, this is our original face before we were born. before we were born into identification with a separate, limited self. Recognizing our own power to love points us directly to recognizing this primordial radiance. And then, this is from Kevin Griffin's book, Living Kindness. When it comes to loving others, it makes sense that if our feelings towards ourselves are unkind, any effort to be kind to others will be adulterated. These efforts will always be colored by some form of neediness. Either we will be trying to get validation from others or trying to compensate for our lack of self-worth by being extra good. These external efforts will never succeed as long as our inner world feels barren. It is that very barren feeling that makes us think we don't deserve love. We look inside and see anxiety and sadness, worry and stress, and irritation and judgment. Then we equate feeling bad for being bad. This is a very profound sentence. We equate feeling bad for being bad. In this formulation, if we are bad, then clearly we don't deserve love. All those think times when we, because we're human, have thoughts about ourselves in this sort of mode, you know, like, oh, I'm not as smart as all those other people, or, you know, I don't practice nearly as much as they do, or I've never been a really good parent, or you know stuff. You know, we all have these thoughts, and we take those thoughts to be real and who we are. I'm the person who's never been a good enough whatever, and that stops us from opening our hearts, because we're not deserving of feeling thoughts of loving kindness all the time. And this is another place where we really have to do, this is where this practice brings up this stuff, and we have to work in this world, this area of our heart mind. Then as I mentioned, there's people who are just difficult for whatever reason. We try and have thoughts of loving kindness towards them, and it's like, basically, you know, it sticks in our throats. But you can flip the idea of metta over, in a sense. Since don't think of metta as adding something, wholesome thoughts. Instead, think of removing unwholesome thoughts. Sometimes it's easier to think of removing things than adding things, especially when it comes to other people. So, and directly in the sutta it says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. I mean, it's quite precise. But it's like, can you just remove those thoughts? Can you, instead of having to add in thoughts of loving kindness towards everyone, can you at least not get caught in yet again having thoughts of ill will? It's for some people this is a simpler way to practice metta, in a sense, especially at the beginning when we're really struggling. I want to read a little bit more of Kevin here. And he's referring to a sutta called the Simile of the Saw. The theme of the sutta is the challenge of maintaining non-ill will in the face of attacks, verbal and physical. Here we see one of the rhetorical teaching strategies of the Buddha. He seems to understand that a positive declaration of love, to love everyone, can trigger grasping. In other words, I have to do this. I've got to be it. I've got to be the perfect metta person, right? We turn it into this big project where we have to be perfect. We seem so instead points us towards letting go of the obstructions to love. So instead of trying to add in more love, can I just remove the obstructions? In this way, his rhetoric mirrors the teachings themselves. Letting go is the path to freedom. So he tells us that what to let go of. If instead he had set out some ideal to strive for, it would just give people something else to chase after. This is a really interesting way to think of metta. It's like, can I not make this into some giant project that I have to, be really good at? Can I instead look at it as just letting go of this stuff that isn't useful and causes harm and suffering? Again, the implication is that our natural state when rid of these negative qualities is a positive one, that when hatred is removed, love is naturally revealed, that when greed subsides, generosity is spontaneous. This is an essential Buddhist concept, that our fundamental human nature is loving and wise. The work of Buddhist practice is to abandon the things that obscure those qualities in us. This is one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism and to the Buddhist practice more than anything else. Having grown up, in a Christian world, a Christian family, where basically it's like, you got to sort of control all these things because basically you're full of not good stuff. The opposite is true, and so you have to control. Your job is to you pray that God helps you to control your unholy urges, because you're full of bad stuff. This was the message I got over and over again growing up. And in Buddhism, they say no, naturally you're just naturally whole and pure. Your natural state, if you just let go of that junk that floats around in your mind about how you're not good, if you just let go of that, your natural state shines out, which is one of full of loving kindness. It just feels more real to me. It removes the wagging finger of the Judeo-Christian world. And I'm not saying all Christians are bad or anything like that, because I want to make that clear too. But there's this underlying message in those teachings that's always there, where you have to sort of, control things and be careful. Not that you don't have to be careful of practicing Buddhism too, but now you're being careful to let things go so your natural beauty can shine through. Then there's this passage from Sharon I love to read. And she's talking about how we practice. And this is more, I've been talking about methods of like a meditation practice, but methods also just like a practice in daily life. Can we just over and over and over again with whomever we're reacting with, can we have thoughts of loving kindness towards this person? Whoever it is, without exception. It's just, in practicing metta, we didn't have to make a certain feeling happen. This is another thing, like somehow or other we get this idea that, well, if I'm practicing metta and I'm saying these phrases, I should just get all sort of sweet and gushy. I should just be overflowing right from the beginning. Right? In practicing metta, we do not have to make a certain feeling happen. In fact, during the practice, we see that we feel differently at different times. Any momentary emotional tone is far less relevant than the considerable power of intention we harness as we say the phrases. When, as we say the phrases, we are planting seeds by forming this powerful intention in the mind. The seed will bear fruit in its own time. So this is wholesome intention. We're forming, here's the, you know, the Buddhist Eightfold Path again, only here it is back at step two, right? Like we're forming the wholesome intention by practicing. And that wholesome intention in and of itself is really powerful. And she tells a little story here. When I was practicing metta intensively in Burma, at times when I repeated the phrases, I picture myself in a wide open field planting seeds. Doing metta, we plant the seeds of love. Knowing that nature will take its course in time, those seeds will bear fruit. Some seeds will come to fruition quickly, some slowly, but our work is simply to plant the seeds. Every time we form the intention in the mind for our own happiness or the happiness of others, we are doing our work. We are channeling the powerful energies of our own mind intentionally. I have a little story to tell here that illustrates what she's saying. The first time I really practiced metta, and you know, I did a little bit of metta practice, you know, like one meditation period a day on a long retreat. It'd be a time when everybody practiced metta, and it was like, yeah, it's okay. Then I decided, for various reasons I won't go into, that I wanted to really intensely practice. And I did, went to Spirit Rock, and I actually practiced for an entire month, my entire practice, with the help of Guy, my teacher at the time, was to just practice metta. So I just, as much as I could, from the moment I woke up to the moment I fell asleep, for a whole month, repeated the phrases. And it was like, it was very powerful, because it's quite a powerful concentration practice. But it was like, my thoughts were like, yeah, you know, I can see this sort of sweet, wholesome thing to do, but I didn't feel very gushy or anything for the whole month. I was just like, you know, doing the practice and noting, you know, seeing how I got more and more concentrated and getting really interested in that. But you know, this idea of sort of I'm planting seeds was like, yeah, sure. Then I came home to Boulder, and a couple of days later, I was going to Whole Foods to shop. I had a very short list because I didn't want to spend too much time, because Whole Foods is a pretty high energy place. But I don't know if you've ever been to Whole Foods around 11 in the morning, but it's full of parents with their little kids. And I was just like, you know, going through the shelves of Whole Foods, putting things in my basket. But every time I encountered a child, I'd stop and sort of hang out with them, you know, and, you know, make silly faces and just be this, you know, grandfatherly old guy. And every one of these kids got tuned into it right away, and we sort of hung out. And all the parents, when they realized what was going on, they were totally cool with the fact that this strange old guy was hanging out with their kid, and sort of, I wasn't like touching them or anything, I was just like, you know, interacting with them verbally and visually. And so it took me like 25 minutes to get 11 items at Whole Foods. And it was just like, I kept, you know, having this same encounter over and over again, just like hanging out with these kids and with the parents sometimes. And then as I was leaving, it struck me, oh, all those seeds coming to fruition. It's like I could see how that thought that I was just like, you know, being this really concentrated, serious person, at the same time, I just had planted these seeds, and they just, right there in Whole Foods, it was really obvious, they were just coming out, just like that. It's just, that's the nature of the practice. One other thing, and I want to mention this as well, is that metta often we look at metta as like, well, it's metta and then there's mindfulness, right? Like these are two separate things. But they're very tightly interrelated. This is from Sylvia Boorstein's book, Happiness is an Inside Job. And she's talking about practicing metta. When I was introduced to metta practice 25 years ago, I was told that it was different, not only in technique but also in goal, from mindfulness. And this is how I first encountered it, exactly the same way. In fact, it was and still sometimes is presented as an ancillary practice to use in case of special needs, such as perilous circumstances, or as a formal ritual ending for retreat practice, part of a dedication of merit. What I have come to believe out of my experience is that mindfulness and metta, although they are associated with different techniques, are each of them integral to the practice of the other. I cannot be genuinely mindful, open to my moment-to-moment experience without hesitation or hiding, unless my mind is benevolent, unless I forgive whatever part of my experience arouses distress in me. Indeed, it is the mindful awareness I'm in pain, or someone else is, that causes feelings of goodwill to spontaneously arise in me. And I couldn't seriously practice metta without paying very careful attention to, being mindful of, whether what I am wishing matches what I feel. In my experience is the repeated direct awareness of how benevolent connection, friendliness, compassion, appreciation liberates my mind from suffering that supports both wisdom and equanimity in me and inspires my determination to stay alert. So if you're going to consciously try and have thoughts of loving kindness to everyone you encounter during the day, it takes a lot of mindfulness. Because mindfulness means, remember one, you know, the word sati, which is translated as mindfulness, another translation is just remembering. You just got to remember over and over and over again to have thoughts of loving kindness to people we encounter, no matter what the situation. You know, just plant more seeds. Don't forget, got to plant more seeds. There's a really beautiful section. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya as well. This is a sutta where there's these three monks that live together in the forest, and it's a little, their own little three-person retreat. And the Buddhists come to sort of hang out with them and see how they're doing, you know, like checking in on the students, right? And surely, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without dispute, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. But how do you live thus? Venerable Sir, as to this, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I love that this is openly and privately. And there's like, I don't have to make a big deal about it. I don't have to let them even know that I'm doing it. I'm just doing it. I'm consciously trying to express loving kindness in my relationship with these other two people. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. And then the other two monks say, yeah, and us too. They say, this is exactly what we do as well. Wouldn't it be interesting to live that way all the time? To always be consciously having openly and privately thoughts and actions and words of loving kindness towards the people around us, everyone, without exception. There's also further on in that sutta, they're describing, like, well, if I'm finished eating before the other people, then I just start doing the dishes, sort of thing. There's no idea of like you have to, I'm making sure that the other people do their share and I do my share and it's all equal and it all comes out. They just don't do that at all. And I remind when I read that, I remembered. There's a guy named Stephen Gaskin who started a place called The Farm, which is in Tennessee. It's a intentional community that does a lot of really wonderful service work for others, as well as living off the land, living really simply. And I saw him speak once, and one thing he said, it's always stuck in my mind. And it was like, the lowest form of cooperation is turn taking. The lowest form of cooperation is turn taking. Interesting thought, huh? Like, we don't think taking turns is good, which it is. It's better than chaos. But the lowest form of cooperation is turn taking. There's lots better forms of cooperation where the cooperation is just a natural expression of loving kindness towards the others we're with. And then there's this poem. This is a Naomi Shihab Nye from her book Words Under the Words, and it's a poem called Kindness, where she's speaking to this idea. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all of this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Only kindness. That's metta in poetry. One last thought. This is something I wrote. We are drawn to loving kindness because we have all suffered and we understand that everyone else, without exception, has also suffered. We're all human beings. We're all in this together. We can't separate it out. We're all, that's the basic thing, that we're all the same. Is that we've all suffered, and we all will suffer more, and we've also all had periods of joy, and this is, we're human beings, and it's like the human condition. That means that I would wish them all well. So, that's what I have to say today. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.